Welcome to JS on Politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and here's a look at what's ahead on a very busy show today. The last presidential debate is in the books. We'll take a look back at key moments for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. We'll also talk about how the race is shaping up in Wisconsin. Since we last aired, Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold debated twice. Is that race as close as the polls say? Plus, we'll look at some of the races down the ballot, and we'll give you our winners and losers from the past week. Well, let's start with last night's debate and bring in Craig Gilbert, our Washington bureau chief. So, Craig, first, can you just compare this debate to the first two in terms of content and tone? What struck you about last night's debate?
Well, there were stretches when it felt like a much more substantive and even civil debate and issue-oriented debate than the other two debates. I mean, they spent a lot of time on important issues like foreign policy and taxes. But it's rare, it's not that common to have a debate kind of overtaken by a single answer to a single question, like this one was last night when Donald Trump was asked if he'd accept the results of the election and answered that he'll make that decision at a later time. And that kind of took the focus away from anything else he was trying to accomplish in the debate and probably left the debate in a place where he wouldn't have wanted going in.
Yeah, so let's talk about Trump's performance and his, you know, how things went for him last night first. So he comes in behind in the polls, behind in the swing states, needs to sort of reset things. And at the beginning of the debate, as you sort of hinted at, it was sort of, you know, a more presidential appearance for Trump. But what did he do what he needed to do, or is he just, you know, still in kind of a tailspin here?
No, I don't think he did what he needed to do. I mean, it was a tall order going in. I mean, he's been losing ground in the race. Third debates aren't typically where you see a lot of movement in the race, but he needed a lot of movement. And one interesting thing, you know, he started out pretty kind of collected and calm, and it was obvious from the start, I thought, that Hillary Clinton was trying to bait him from the get-go. I mean, she sort of has the upper hand in the race. You could expect her maybe to play it safe, but, you know, she's talked about him choking with his meeting with the president of Mexico by not mentioning the wall. She was kind of throwing these jabs and darts at him throughout the debate, and eventually he started reacting to them and getting testy, and that's I don't think that accomplishes his political mission of trying to broaden his coalition.
All right, and let's talk about Hillary Clinton. So since the last debate, there have been more of these WikiLeaks revelations about emails and things. She had a few pointed questions thrown her way, too. How do you think she fared just in general and specifically on some of those new allegations that have come out?
Well, I would say partly, I mean, she fared well in the sense that she was collected and she didn't, you know, blow it and didn't lose her poise and didn't make any bad mistakes. But she was also kind of allowed to get away with steering the subject away from some of these issues. I think, you know, there are always glimpses in these debates of Hillary Clinton's vulnerability. And you think what might have happened had she had a different debate opponent. But in often the case was that Donald Trump didn't follow up on issues where she was vulnerable or she was allowed to kind of steer the conversation in different directions. So I think she benefited from her own pretty skilled performance and also from the fact that she was kind of allowed to get away with moving off some subjects that where she is more vulnerable.
All right, let's go back to what you referenced early on about Donald Trump's statement, because he was asked, I mean, Chris Wallace gave him a couple opportunities to say, look, your running mate said you'll, of course, accept the results of the election. Your campaign manager said that. What do you say? And he dodged and hedged and said, well, no, I'll decide that later. How, and that's the headline in just about every major news outlet today. How badly of a stumble, and how bad of a stumble was that, do you think?
Well, I think it was a bad stumble for a couple of reasons. One, because it became the story, and two, because at a time when there's a lot of doubts among voters about his temperament, I think he kind of amplified those doubts. I mean, what was damaging about the exchange wasn't just his answer, but it was the way that Chris Wallace of Fox News framed the question. It wasn't just, you know, do you think there will be any problems with the elections? Are you going to accept the election results? He framed it as a peaceful transition of power. And when he framed it that way, Donald Trump still said, basically, I'll let you know at the time. And so it came across not just as complaining about the political process, but about raising questions about whether he would accept a peaceful transition to power, which is just not a signal, I think, that most voters like hearing.
All right, and in the final, you know, week, couple, 2 weeks and a half here, what what can Donald Trump do in your mind to change the trajectory of this, or are we getting to the point where it's kind of too late for him?
Well, it's getting awfully late. We've been through the debates now, so he doesn't have a debate opportunity to sort of turn things around. He doesn't have a big television budget. He's not going to be outspending Hillary Clinton like mad on television at the end of the campaign. You know, to some degree, I think it's out of his hands. I don't know that it's not easy for a candidate on his own just to repair his own negatives. I think to some degree, he's just at the mercy of events, at the mercy of, we've seen at earlier stages in the campaign where Hillary Clinton had a bad patch, where there were revelations that came out about her, where she had her health problems. That was kind of out beyond Donald Trump's control, and this may be beyond Donald Trump's control, whether there's anything that would happen in the closing days of the campaign that would be very harmful to Hillary Clinton, who is right now in a pretty commanding position.
All right, well, we'll leave our discussion there, and we'll continue on our show with some more discussion about how the race is shaping up in Wisconsin. Thanks, Craig.
Right.
We're joined now by Mary Spicuzza and Dan Bice to talk about their impressions of the debate last night and how the race is shaping up in Wisconsin. Mary, what did you think?
You know, at first, I did not think it was... I thought it was going to be Trump's best debate. I felt like he seemed more presidential. He was kind of talking about issues. But then I thought it went off the rails for him about not accepting the results and keeping us all in suspense and the such a nasty woman remark at the end.
I do think it's funny. Everyone's been talking about how well Trump did the first 30 minutes, but there were several things he said that just weren't true, including saying that he didn't refer to people's appearance in some of the people who are making accusations.
He said those have been debunked, which haven't.
Yeah. Those haven't actually been.
No.
But, you know, the fact is he does pretty well, I think, in stretches for like 30 minutes. I think the 90-minute thing just doesn't work for him.
Well, I mean, as Craig had noted, there were spots where Hillary Clinton clearly was throwing things out to get his ire up.
And it didn't provoke him for the first 40 minutes or so. It didn't provoke him, but then finally, and she's been able to provoke him in each of the debates. This time it just took a little bit longer. And actually it's Chris Wallace who seems to have provoked him and then brought back around the question of are you going to accept the results of this election? And then he says, I'll leave you in suspense as if this is a game show or something.
Next season, we come back. So let's talk a little bit about the strategy here in Wisconsin. So we're seeing Donald Trump, he was back again this week in the Green Bay area. Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, is trying to expand the map into Arizona and other places. What do you think of the strategy on both parts? Is Wisconsin something for Trump to be focusing on? And is Hillary smart to look into new broader areas?
Obviously, there's not been a poll so far that shows Trump ahead in Wisconsin, but he likes to come to Green Bay because he is doing well in the Green Bay area, but it doesn't make a lot of sense for him to be focusing here when he's losing ground in some of the other states, as you said, like Arizona, and now she's closing in Texas and other states where you expect him to be doing strongly. But sometimes he does these weird trips where he goes to states where the race is not actually in play.
And he had been uninvited by Paul Ryan to the Elkhorn event, so it seemed like he was kind of, I'm going back to Wisconsin whether I'm invited or not. So he obviously didn't go to Ryan's district. He went to Green Bay instead. But I kind of wonder if that was a little bit of a poke in the eye of Paul Ryan.
I was talking to someone just on Monday about the Trump event here, and the person said, this is the most disorganized campaign I've ever been involved in at any level here in the state of Wisconsin. So I don't think we should read too much into in terms of whether
the strategy
is... Right.
The internal polls showing something. Maybe there are no internal polls.
So
I don't know.
Part of the strategy or not strategy is to claim that the election is rigged. And we've heard that a lot. Now, if you look at Wisconsin, you've got Republicans in the governor's office covering the legislature, Republican attorney general. You've got a lot of
Supreme Court.
Put a lot of clerks around the country, around the state rather, in Republican counties. Does this play at all well? I mean, especially if Ron Johnson does well and Trump doesn't, does that just sort of undermines the Republicans on the ballot?
Well, right? He also said the Wisconsin primary was rigged, and when we talked to him shortly before the election, I remember talking to him at Miss Katie's Diner, and he felt like the conservative talk show hosts here were rigging the election against him, that the Wisconsin Republicans were rigging the election against him. So I think it's true that he tends to say that things are rigged if he's not winning.
Yeah, but rigged has sort of a specific connotation.
In elections, sort of, it does.
That it's an uphill battle, or everyone's against me, we're against the odds. This is to say
that's,
it's
that's a different thing, to suggest that.
Right?
And he's actually wandered into that by saying that there are a lot of people who are on the voter rolls, and his campaign manager said that as well, that there are people who are dead who are on the voter rolls and stuff. So they're seeming to suggest that there's some massive voter fraud that's going on. They won't quite go and say that completely, but it does seem to suggest that it's an attempt to undermine the entire election process across the country. And it is true, it works against a lot of other candidates at the local level. If they win at the local level, then this sort of thing throws that into doubt.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the Paul Ryan strategy. You mentioned him before. At least Ryan's strategy seems to be ignore Trump now, because as Trump's firing off, you know, more tweets and things. Good strategy, bad strategy? How is Paul Ryan going to come out of this?
Well, actually, it's interesting. In the Washington Post today, Sean Hannity is quoted saying after the debate last night that he considers Paul Ryan to be a saboteur and that he's going to work to try to defeat him in the next election, which seems to imply that Paul Ryan's strategy of just trying to avoid this thing, wait till November 8th and everything will be okay, might not work, since the Trump people might want to extend this beyond this election and extend it into the next election. I mean, it's going to work for him in the short term because Paul Ryan's going to win. There's a Trump super PAC that's targeting Ryan and telling people to vote against him, but he's going to win re-election, and more than likely he's going to be the House Speaker. This election has thrown the Republican Party into some sort of disarray, and we'll have to see how that works out.
Yeah, that's my next question there. It's a pretty safe assumption that Paul Ryan's going to win and that he'll be the House Speaker, right? Do we see any eroding of his core support among House members, especially if Ryan's mission right now is protect these other members, right? He's going to have some loyalty there, presumably, to keep his...
There certainly have been coups with speakers before where they get ousted. I don't know that this would be the thing that would oust him as speaker. His job could be more difficult if they do lose seats, partly as a result of Trump, and it's a, you know, smaller majority, so he's trying to lead, and then people are divided. So it could certainly make his job harder. I don't see him losing the speakership over this, but I could be wrong.
All right. Well, that's a good place to leave our discussion for now. We're going to go right now to this next segment on how the two candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, fared on the Truth-O-Meter last night. We're joined now by Tom Kircher, one of our PolitiFact Wisconsin reporters, to talk about the debate last night and how the candidates fared on the Truth-O-Meter. So, Tom, we're going to run through some claims here, first starting with one from Donald Trump, who said Hillary Clinton's plan is going to raise taxes and even double your taxes, and that was rated mostly false.
There have been independent analyses. They've found that for the vast majority of taxpayers, no increase or actually a tax cut. There are people on the high end of the income scale who will see their taxes go up, although it's unclear how many will see their taxes double.
All right, and now a claim from Hillary Clinton, who said we have 33,000 people a year who die from guns, and that was rated mostly true.
That number is correct, at least for the last 3 years for which statistics are available. However, two-thirds of the 33,000 are suicide.
All right, and now back to Donald Trump, who said Hillary Clinton, quote, wanted a wall, and this, of course, means with Mexico. Mm-hmm. That's rated half true.
Yeah, this is a matter of scale, if you will. She did vote for a law in 2006 to erect fencing around about 700 miles of the coast, the border. However, she's not backing the type of wall that Trump has talked about, which would be more like 1,000 miles and a much more formidable structure.
All right. And from Hillary Clinton, her claim was, we have 17 intelligence agencies, civilian and military, who have all concluded that those espionage attacks, these cyber attacks, come from the highest levels of the Kremlin, and they are designed to influence our election, and that was rated true.
That's a reference to what's been put out by WikiLeaks, the emails. The director of intelligence for the federal government, who does oversee 17 agencies, says the consensus is that those were hacked by Russia.
All right. And back to Donald Trump, whose claim was that heroin pours across our southern borders, and this was rated true.
Heroin does come across the borders from South America, and Mexico is a major source of heroin in the U.S.
All right, and finally one more from Hillary Clinton. She said what the District of Columbia was trying to do with its handgun ban was to protect toddlers from guns, and that was rated half true.
Yeah, the ordinance that the District of Columbia put in place was partly aimed at trying to protect toddlers. However, there was also a provision to ban any guns that were not registered with the district.
All right. Thanks, Tom. And for those who are looking for those claims or more, you can find them at PolitiFact.com. All right, we're back again with Dan and Mary to talk about the U.S. Senate race. So there have been two debates. The only two debates have occurred over the last few days. Dan, what was your sense on, you know, takeaways from those debates? Did that dynamic of that race change at all?
I don't think so. And actually watching the debates, I was more interested in whether the candidates telecast how they're seeing their standing right now. And in both debates, I thought Russ Feingold was very cool, calm, and collected. In the second debate, the one this week with Mike Gaucher, I think Ron Johnson appeared very eager, extremely eager, maybe a little caffeinated, trying to get to his points very quickly, jumped right in on the first or second question and decided to attack Russ Feingold on Progressives United, even though the question had nothing to do with the subject. And throughout the debate, he continued to try to attack. And it gave the sense that it reminds me of the candidate who's trailing in a race who feels like if they could just get one or two more points across, the voters would realize that they're wrong and that they're supporting the wrong candidate.
Yeah. So do you think anything from those debates changes the dynamic, though? I mean, right now it's 2 percentage points, I think it was, in the Marquette poll. That suggests it's a toss-up.
It does, so. But that's why I was thinking, that's why I thought the debate didn't seem to be like a debate between a race within the margin of error. It appeared to be a race in which Russ Feingold appears to have a little bit more of a lead, and maybe their internal polling shows something that we haven't seen so far. Was there anything that was in the debate? No, I don't think so. I mean, the one thing that a lot of people were talking about was how much Ron Johnson was sweating throughout the thing. I mean, he was just very, very eager and trying to make his points so aggressively throughout the whole thing. It wasn't a terrible performance, but it wasn't a good performance.
All right. Let me ask you, Mary, before we close this section of the show, what should we be watching for in these final weeks? To see if it's truly as close as it is, or is it a barometer of the outside money or the organizing? What's the key now for them both down the stretch?
I think we'll be looking at advertising. Can Ron Johnson pick up ground with either positive ads about himself, or will there be third-party groups spending attacking Russ Feingold? I think it's also interesting to see if third-party groups start dropping out and running and going to other races, which would show that it is further, you know, that it's more internal polling shows it's more than a 2-point spread. So that's interesting to see.
I thought early in this race, I got this sense that Ron Johnson was sort of like, if I win, that's great. If I lose, that's great, too. I think he's actually changed where he has made it clear. He said at the end of the debate he will not run for a third term if he wins. But I think what turned this race around and made it a lot closer is the fact that he clearly wants to win a second term now, and he's been running hard for the last month or month and a half. The thing is, will that put him over the top? Right now it's gotten him close. Will it get him the extra percentage?
Tough challenge, too, if Hillary Clinton's doing as well in Wisconsin as
right.
The polls are showing.
He's going to turn out presidential years.
And he's going to have, and things.
And he's going to have to outperform Trump by a good percentage in Wisconsin.
All right, so we'll leave that discussion there for now. We'll take a look now in this next segment at some of the races down the ballot on the November election. We're joined now by Patrick Marley and Jason Stein of our Madison Bureau to talk about some of the races down the ballot. So, Jason, let me ask you first about the 8th Congressional District in the Green Bay area. It's really our main competitive one. How is that race shaping up?
Right. So, obviously, because of redistricting, you once had two or three usually competitive congressional seats in Wisconsin. Now you just have this one, the 8th Congressional, where former Marine Mike Gallagher is running against Outagamie County exec Tom Nelson. And although that race seemed a few weeks ago to become less competitive, and you were seeing some outside groups pulling some of their money out of the race or not spending it, since Donald Trump made his remarkable comments in recent weeks, you're seeing some renewed interest in that race. We'll see if it actually becomes competitive, but we have seen a few groups putting more money into the race, suggesting that, you know, it they might be seeing it as at least a potential to pick up or see a switch
so
in control.
The money, when you say Donald Trump's comments, it's made it more tantalizing for the Democrats to get involved? Is
potentially. And, you know, and I think it's really an open question, because I think what we've seen in certain polling is that there does seem to be a return to that endangered species, the ticket splitter, that we haven't seen in a while. So I don't think, even if Hillary Clinton does carry the state by a significant amount, there may still be ticket splitting, and it may not trickle down to these other races. But certainly I think you've seen renewed interest in these other races and the possibility that you might see more of a Democratic wave this year.
Trump has been performing better in Green Bay than in southeastern Wisconsin, so the area for Democrats to make inroads.
Yeah, let's take a step down to the next level on the ballot, the state Senate, where just the other day the Democratic leader, Jennifer Schilling, said, you know, if we have a good year, we might pick up two seats, which isn't enough for control.
Right.
Patrick, why is that, and what's happening there?
Well, there's really only one seat that's in true play. That's the 18th Senate District in sort of the Fond du Lac area. It's an open seat and very competitive, but the rest of the board, it looks like it's pretty clear who's going to win. And so it is quite a concession for the Democratic majority leader or minority leader to say, you know, if things go really well, we'll get two seats, which is one shy of what they would need to take control.
And to go one step below to the Assembly, and no one really expects that the Republicans would lose control there, but if there is, say, a very strong Hillary Clinton showing, is there the prospect that they will erode some of their
So, edge? Again, they have very well-designed seats for Republicans. They're pretty protected, but the Democrats, it's a 69-39 control in Republicans' favor, so the hope for Democrats is to make a big enough inroad there that they can make a plausible claim to take control in 2018. They're hoping that Clinton does really well here, that Feingold does really well here, and they can maybe get half a dozen seats. But that would only get them halfway to where they need to be.
The seats for this, of course, weren't sown in this election. They were sown years ago in the redistricting, right? I mean, talk a little bit, Jason, about where we are just from that political power standpoint in the state, that are Republicans in control for the long term here?
Right, so that's a great question.
Happening?
I mean, you know, certainly in past years, it can be difficult to see a wave coming in legislative races because you get very little good polling. And so it's difficult to fully predict what's going to happen. But certainly one thing that we have seen is over a number of years, particularly since the 2011 redistricting, we have fewer competitive races. We have fewer races decided by 5 points, fewer races decided by less than 10 points than we used to have. And it was in 2014 was really one of the lowest points in many cycles in Wisconsin. So even if you see a few more seats change hands or a few more competitive races in 2016, which you very well might, it still becomes very difficult for something meaningful to happen in legislative races because there is just much less ability for the two parties to compete for seats than there used to be. I mean, the Republicans just have cemented a pretty stable majority right now.
So if you're a Democrat, Patrick, let me ask you this question before we wrap up. I mean, what is it going to take? Because, I mean, you need to be in control when you're redrawing the maps after the 2020 census, right? But is there any prospect they will be in strong control at that
point? So, I mean, if the maps stay as they are, Democrats have a distinct disadvantage in doing that. So they really have two hopes. One, there's this lawsuit over redistricting that will be decided after the election. Their hope is that the court says the maps were drawn too much in favor, that partisanship was taken too much into account, and that they can redraw the seats at that point. If they lose that case, then their real hope is to win the governor's race in 2018 so that they control at least one part of the power when the next maps are drawn, because the legislature would draw the maps, but the governor has the ability to sign off on them or
veto
stop them.
That. And if the elected officials of the state can't approve a series of maps and agree on a series of maps, then the courts would draw them.
Right.
One other thing that's worth noting is that, you know, there have been other times in the past where, like Democrats in the 1970s, where one party really did have a stranglehold on the legislature. But in a state like Wisconsin, that is such a closely contested state, that is never going to last forever. So, I mean, sooner or later, something will break that equilibrium. And, another party will take power, and then that will in time change, too. I mean, so you can still count on that.
So you're telling us the show will be here in the future, our show,
We're always receptive to talk about. That's right.
Plenty of elections in the 2020s for us to talk about.
End it today. You can We'll see a little bit more on the show as we go along, but thanks, Jason and Patrick.
Thanks.
We're back with Dan and Mary for a final segment here. They keep changing and in and out, and really throw the hardcore through the show today.
We're going to start switching seats.
Yeah, that would be a little confusing for me included. So let's go to our winners and losers. Mary, first, who is your winner of the week?
Mike Goucher. I think that obviously journalists take a lot of heat for not asking tough questions and not doing a good job, but I think that he is obviously always a very talented, or typically a very talented, debate moderator, and I think that this week was no exception.
All right, and Dan, let's get your winner of the week.
So my winner of the week's Chris Wallace. So it's not the candidates who are winning this week, but it's the moderators. I thought he did the best job of the three moderators, actually four moderators, at the presidential debates. There are some criticisms since he didn't bring up issues like climate change, but I thought he did a good job covering a lot of territory, jumping in when he needed to, backing off when he didn't, actually pointing out to both candidates when they had contradicted themselves or when they had stated something that was not true.
Or not answered the question. Also.
Or not answered the question.
You're saying the moderators could be winners of the week sometimes. This gives me hope here, but Dan, let's
go to your... Does that make Greg a winner too? Yeah.
Winner by extension. So, Dan, who's your loser of the week?
My loser is Sheriff Clark. I had him as my winner 2 weeks ago, but he's my loser this week. He was tweeting like mad over the weekend about how it was pitchforks and torches time in America. This law and order sheriff who was suggesting civil unrest, and he backed off of that a little bit on Monday, posting a blog post saying that he was not speaking in code, but at the same time was speaking figuratively. So I'm not sure what exactly that means, but it brought him national attention, international attention, for his comments. And you know, in particular, since he's acting as a surrogate for Donald Trump, this is a pretty unusual thing for someone to be saying.
It certainly fed into the rigged election theme that was going on. And other
it was. You know, it's as Donald Trump gets more and more agitated about things, you can count on Sheriff Clark to amp it up to one more notch.
All right. And Mary, your loser of the week.
I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, but Scott Foval, or Foval, I would say, who lost his job after the latest Project Veritas video filmed by O'Keefe and Company. And obviously he was on tape bragging about not rigging elections, but about interfering, about sending people to disrupt Governor Walker's event at the Iowa State Fair, talked about half of the state being racist. You know, obviously there's talking big at the bar, and then there is talking big at the bar on tape and saying things that are going to get you fired.
All right. So that's where we'll end our show today. We have several more shows before the November 8th elections. We hope you'll join us then. We also hope you'll join us tomorrow afternoon, Friday at 4 o'clock. Senator Ron Johnson will be meeting with the editorial board of the Journal Sentinel, and that will be streamed live on our website, jsonline.com, and on Facebook. So we'll be back next week. See you then.